coldly. I'm afraid of him. Mrs. Groves's large face showed me at this for the first time the faraway faint glimmer of a consciousness more acute. I somehow made out in it the delayed dawn of an idea I myself had not given her, and that was as yet quite obscure to me. It comes back to me that I thought instantly of this as something I could get from her, and I felt it to be connected with the desire she presently showed to know more. When was it on the tower? About the middle of the month, at this same hour. Almost at dark, said Mrs. Groves. Oh, no, no, not nearly. I saw him as I see you. Then how did he get in? And how did he get out? I laughed. I had no opportunity to ask him. This evening, you see, I pursued, he has not been able to get in. He only peeps. I hope it will be confined to that. She had now let go my hand. She turned away a little. I waited an instant. Then I brought out, Go to church. Goodbye. I must watch. Slowly she faced me again. Do you fear for them? We met in another long look. Don't you? Instead of answering, she came nearer to the window and for a minute applied her face to the glass. You see how he could see, I meanwhile went on. She didn't move. How long was he here? Till I came out. I came to meet him. Mrs. Groves at last turned round, and there was still more in her face. I couldn't have come out. Neither could I laughed again. But I did come. I have my duty. So have I mine, she replied, after which she added, What is he like? I've been dying to tell you, but he's like nobody. Nobody? She echoed. He has no hat. Then, seeing in her face that she already in this, with a deeper dismay, found a touch of picture, I quickly added stroke to stroke. He has red hair, very red, close curling, and a pale face, long in shape, with straight good features and little, rather queer whiskers that are as red as his hair. His eyebrows are somehow darker. They look particularly arched, and as if they might move a good deal. His eyes are sharp, strange, awfully. But I only know clearly that they're rather small and very fixed. His mouth's wide, and his lips are thin, and except for his little whiskers, he's quite clean-shaven. He gives me a sort of sense of looking like an actor.
An actor?
It was impossible to resemble one less, at least, than Mrs. Groves at that moment. I've never seen one, but so I suppose them. He's tall, active, erect, I continued, but never, no, never a gentleman. My companion's face had blanched as I went on. Her round eyes started, and her mild mouth gaped.
A gentleman! She gasped, confounded, stupefied. A gentleman, he.
You know him, then?
She visibly tried to hold herself. But he is handsome.
I saw the way to help her. Remarkably.
And dressed?
In somebody's clothes. They're smart, but they're not his own. She broke into a breathless affirmative groan.
They're the master's!
I caught it up. You do know him. She faltered but a second.
Quint!
She cried.
Quint? Peter Quint, his own man, his valet when he was here.
When the master was. Gaping still but meeting me, she pieced it all together.
He never wore his hat, but he did wear... Well, there were waistcoats missed. They were both here last year. Then the master went and Quint was alone.
I followed, but halting a little.
Alone? Alone with us.
Then, as from a deeper depth.
In charge, she added.
And what became of him? She hung fire so long that I was still more mystified.
He went, too, she brought out at last.
Went where? Her expression at this became... extraordinary.
God knows where, He died. Died? I almost shrieked. She seemed fairly to square herself, plant herself more firmly, to utter the wonder of it. Yes. Mr. Quint is dead.
6. It took, of course, more than that particular passage to place us together in presence of what we had now to live with as we could, my dreadful liability to impressions of the order so vividly exemplified, and my companion's knowledge henceforth, a knowledge half consternation and half compassion of that liability. There had been this evening, after the revelation left me for an hour so prostrate, there had been for either of us no attendance on any service, but a little service of tears and vows, of prayers and promises, a climax to the series of mutual challenges and pledges that had straightway ensued on our retreating together to the schoolroom and shutting ourselves up there to have everything out. The result of our having everything out was simply to reduce our situation to the last rigour of its elements. She herself had seen nothing. Not the shadow of a shadow, and nobody in the house but the governess was in the governess's plight. Yet she accepted without directly impugning my sanity the truth as I gave it to her, and ended by showing me on this ground an awe-stricken tenderness, an expression of the sense of my more than questionable privilege, of which the very breath has remained with me as that of the sweetest of human charities. What was settled between us, accordingly, that night, was that we thought we might bear things together, and I was not even sure that in spite of her exemption, it was she who had the best of the burden. I knew at this hour, I think as well as I knew later, what I was capable of meeting to shelter my pupils. But it took me some time to be wholly sure of what my honest ally was prepared for to keep terms with so compromising a contract. I was queer company enough, quite as queer as the company I received. But as I trace over what we went through, I see how much common ground we must have found in the one idea that by good fortune could steady us. It was the idea, the second movement, that led me straight out, as I may say, of the inner chamber of my dread. I could take the air in the court at least, and there Mrs. Groves could join me. Perfectly can I recall now the particular way strength came to me before we separated for the night. We'd gone over and over every feature of what I had seen. "He was looking for someone else, you say? Someone who was not you?" "He was looking for little Miles." A portentous clearness now possessed me. "That's whom he was looking for."
"But how do you know?"
"I know, I know, I know." My exultation grew. "And you know, my dear." She didn't deny this, but I required, I felt, not even so much telling as that. She resumed in a moment, at any rate.
"What if he should see him?"
"Little Miles? That's what he wants." She looked immensely scared again.
"The child?"
"Heaven forbid, the man! He wants to appear to them." That he might was an awful conception, and yet somehow I could keep it at bay, which, moreover, as we lingered there, was what I succeeded in practically proving. I had an absolute certainty that I should see again what I had already seen, but something within me said that by offering myself bravely as the sole subject of such experience, by accepting, by inviting, by surmounting it all, I should serve as an expiatory victim and guard the tranquillity of my companions. The children, in especial, I should thus fence about and absolutely save. I recall one of the last things I said that night to Mrs. Groves. "It does strike me that my pupils have never mentioned..." She looked at me hard as I musingly pulled up.
"His having been here and the time they were with him?"
"The time they were with him, and his name, his presence, his history in any way."
"Oh, the little lady didn't remember. She never heard or knew."
"The circumstances of his death?" I thought with some intensity. Perhaps not. But Miles would remember. Miles would know.
Ah, don't try him,
broke from Mrs. Groves. I returned to the look she had given me. Don't be afraid, I continued to think. It is rather odd.
That he has never spoken of him?
Never by the least allusion. And you tell me they were great friends?
Oh, it wasn't him, Mrs. Groves with emphasis declared. It was Quint's own fancy, to play with him, I mean, to spoil him.
She paused a moment, then she added, Quint was much too free. This gave me, straight from my vision of his face, such a face, a sudden sickness of disgust. Too free, with my boy.
Too free with everyone.
I forbore for the moment to analyse this description further than by the reflection that a part of it applied to several of the members of the household, of the half-dozen maids and men who were still of our small colony. But there was everything for our apprehension in the lucky fact that no discomfortable legend, no perturbation of scullions, had ever, within anyone's memory, attached to the kind old place. It had neither bad name nor ill fame, and Mrs. Groves, most apparently, only desired to cling to me and to quake in silence. I even put her, the very last thing of all, to the test. It was when, at midnight, she had her hand on the schoolroom door to take leave. I have it from you, then, for it's of great importance, that he was definitely and admittedly bad.
Oh, not admittedly. I knew it, but the master didn't.
And you never told him?
Well, he didn't like tale-bearing. He hated complaints. He was terribly short with anything of that kind, and if people were all right to him,
he wouldn't be bothered with more. This squared well enough with my impressions of him. He was not a trouble-loving gentleman, nor so very particular, perhaps, about some of the company he kept. All the same, I pressed my interlocutress.
I promise you I would have told.
She felt my discrimination.
I dare say I was wrong, but really, I was afraid.
Afraid of what?
Of things that man could do. Quint was so clever. He was so deep.
I took this in still more than probably I showed. You weren't afraid of anything else? Not of his effect?
His effect?
She repeated with a face of anguish and waiting while I faltered. On innocent little precious lives. They were in your charge.
No, they were not in mine, she roundly and distressfully returned. The master believed in him and placed him here because he was supposed not to be well and the country air so good for him, so he had everything to say. Yes, she let me have it, even about them. Them? That creature!
I had to smother a kind of howl.
And you could bear it? No, I couldn't, and I can't now!
And the poor woman burst into tears. A rigid control from the next day was, as I have said, to follow them. Yet how often and how passionately for a week we came back together to the subject. Much as we had discussed it that Sunday night, I was, in the immediate later hours in especial, for it may be imagined whether I slept, still haunted with the shadow of something she had not told me. I myself had kept back nothing. But there was a word Mrs. Groves had kept back. I was sure, moreover, by morning, that this was not from a failure of frankness, but because on every side there were fears. It seems to me, indeed, in retrospect, that by the time the morrow's sun was high, I had restlessly read into the fact before us almost all the meaning they were to receive from subsequent and more cruel occurrences. What they gave me above all was just the sinister figure of the living man, the dead one would keep a while, and of the months he had continuously passed at Bligh, which added up made a formidable stretch. The limit of this evil time had arrived only when, on the dawn of a winter's morning, Peter Quint was found by a labourer going to early work, stone dead on the road from the village, a catastrophe explained superficially at least by a visible wound to his head, such a wound as might have been produced and, as on the final evidence had been, by a fatal slip in the dark and after leaving the public house on the steepish, icy slope, a wrong path altogether, at the bottom of which he lay. The icy slope, the turn mistaken at night and in liquor, accounted for much, practically, in the end and after the inquest and boundless chatter, for everything. But there had been matters in his life, strange passages and perils, secret disorders, vices more than suspected, that would have accounted for a good deal more. I scarce know how to put my story into words that shall be a credible picture of my state of mind, but I was in these days literally able to find a joy in the extraordinary flight of heroism the occasion demanded of me. I now saw that I had been asked for a service admirable and difficult, and there would be a greatness in letting it be seen, oh, in the right quarter, that I could succeed where many another girl might have failed. It was an immense help to me. I confess I rather applaud myself as I look back, that I saw my service so strongly and so simply. I was there to protect and defend the little creatures in the world the most bereaved and the most lovable, the appeal of whose helplessness had suddenly become only too explicit, a deep, constant ache of one's own committed heart. We were cut off, really, together. We were united in our danger. They had nothing but me, and I, well, I had them. It was, in short, a magnificent chance. This chance presented itself to me in an image richly material. I was a screen. I was to stand before them. The more I saw, the less they would. I began to watch them in a stifled suspense, a disguised excitement that might well, had it continued too long, have turned to something like madness. What saved me, as I now see, was that it turned to something else altogether. It didn't last as suspense. It was superseded by horrible proofs. Proofs, I say, yes, from the moment I really took hold. This moment dated from an afternoon hour that I happened to spend in the grounds with the younger of my pupils alone. We had left Miles indoors on the red cushion of a deep window seat. He had wished to finish a book, and I had been glad to encourage a purpose so laudable in a young man whose only defect was an occasional excess of the restless. His sister, on the contrary, had been alert to come out, and I strolled with her half an hour, seeking the shade, for the sun was still high and the day exceptionally warm. I was aware afresh with her as we went of how, like her brother, she contrived, it was the charming thing in both children, to let me alone without appearing to drop me, and to accompany me without appearing to surround. They were never importunate, and yet never listless. My attention to them all really went to seeing them amuse themselves immensely without me. This was a spectacle they seemed actively to prepare, and that engaged me as an active admirer. I walked in a world of their invention. They had no occasion whatever to draw upon mine, so that my time was taken only with being for them some remarkable person or thing that the game of the moment required, and that was merely, thanks to my superior, my exalted stamp, a happy and highly distinguished sinecure. I forget what I was on the present occasion. I only remember that I was something very important and very quiet, and that Flora was playing very hard. We were on the edge of the lake, and as we had lately begun geography, the lake was the Sea of Azov. Suddenly, in these circumstances, I became aware that on the other side of the Sea of Azov, we had an interested spectator. The way this knowledge gathered in me was the strangest thing in the world. The strangest, that is, except the very much stranger in which it quickly merged itself. I had sat down with a piece of work, for I was something or other that could sit, on the old stone bench which overlooked the pond. And in this position I began to take in with certitude, and yet without direct vision, the presence at a distance of a third person. The old trees, the thick shrubbery, made a great and pleasant shade, but it was all suffused with the brightness of the hot, still hour. There was no ambiguity in anything, None whatever, at least in the conviction I from one moment to another found myself forming as to what I should see straight before me and across the lake as a consequence of raising my eyes. They were attached at this juncture to the stitching in which I was engaged, and I can feel once more the spasm of my effort not to move them till I should so have steadied myself as to be able to make up my mind what to do. There was an alien object in view, a figure whose right of presence I instantly, passionately questioned. I recollect counting over perfectly the possibilities, reminding myself that nothing was more natural, for instance, than the appearance of one of the men about the place, or even of a messenger, a postman, or a tradesman's boy from the village. That reminder had as little effect on my practical certitude as I was conscious, still even without looking, of its having upon the character and attitude of our visitor. Nothing was more natural than that these things should be the other things that they absolutely were not. Of the positive identity of the apparition, I would assure myself as soon as the small clock of my courage should have ticked out the right second. Meanwhile, with an effort that was already sharp enough, I transferred my eyes straight to little Flora, who, at the moment, was about 10 yards away. My heart had stood still for an instant with the wonder and terror of the question whether she too would see, and I held my breath while I waited for what a cry from her, what some sudden innocent sign either of interest or of alarm would tell me. I waited, but nothing came. Then, in the first place, and there is something more dire in this, I feel, than in anything I have to relate, I was determined by a sense that, within a minute, all sounds from her had previously dropped, and in the second, by the circumstance that also within the minute she had, in her play, turned her back to the water. This was her attitude when I at last looked at her, looked with the confirmed conviction that we were still together under direct personal notice. She had picked up a small flat piece of wood, which happened to have in it a little hole, that had evidently suggested to her the idea of sticking in another fragment that might figure as a mast and make the thing a boat. This second morsel, as I watched her, she was very markedly and intently attempting to tighten in its place. My apprehension of what she was doing sustained me so that after some seconds I felt I was ready for more. Then I again shifted my eyes. I faced what I had to face. 7. I got hold of Mrs. Groves as soon after this as I could, and I can give no intelligible account of how I fought out the interval. Yet I still hear myself cry as I fairly threw myself into her arms. They know! It's too monstrous! They know! They know! And what on earth? I felt her incredulity as she held me. Why, all that we know, and heaven knows what else besides! Then, as she released me, I made it out to her, made it out perhaps only now with full coherency, even to myself. 2 hours ago, in the garden, I could scarce articulate. Flora saw... Mrs. Groves took it as she might have taken a blow in the stomach. "She's told you," she panted. "Not a word. That's the horror. She kept it to herself. The child of 8, that child." Unutterable still for me was the stupefaction of it. Mrs. Groves, of course, could only gape the wider. "Then how do you know?" "I was there. I saw with my eyes, saw that she was perfectly aware."
"Do you mean aware of him?"
"No, of her." I was conscious as I spoke that I looked prodigious things, for I got the slow reflection of them in my companion's face. "Another person, this time, but a figure of quite as unmistakable horror and evil. A woman in black, pale and dreadful, with such an air also and such a face. On the other side of the lake, I was there with the child, quiet for the hour, and in the midst of it she came."
Came how? From where? From where they come from? She just appeared and stood there, but not so near. And without coming nearer? Oh, for the effect and the feeling, she might have been as close as you. My friend, with an odd impulse, fell back a step. Was she someone you've never seen? Yes, but someone the child has, someone you have. Then, to show I had thought it all out, my predecessor, the one who died.
Miss Jessel?
Miss Jessel. You don't believe me? I pressed. She turned right and left in her distress.
How can you be sure?
This drew from me, in the state of my nerves, a flash of impatience. Then ask Flora. She's sure. But I had no sooner spoken than I caught myself up. Oh, no, for God's sake, don't. She'll say she isn't. She'll lie. Mrs. Groves was not too bewildered instinctively to protest.
Oh, how can you?
Because I'm clear. Flora doesn't want me to know.
It's only then to spare you.
No, no. There are depths, depths. The more I go over it, the more I see in it, and the more I see in it, the more I fear. I don't know what I don't see, what I don't fear. Mrs. Groves tried to keep up with me.
You mean you're afraid of seeing her again?
Oh, no, that's nothing now. Then I explained. It's of not seeing her. But my companion only looked wan.
I don't understand you.
Why, it's that the child may keep it up, and that the child assuredly will, without my knowing it. At the image of this possibility, Mrs. Groves for a moment collapsed. Yet presently, to pull herself together again, as if from the positive force of the sense of what, should we yield an inch, there would really be to give way to.
Dear, dear, we must keep our heads, and after all, if she doesn't mind it,
she even tried a grim joke.
Perhaps she likes it.
Likes such things. A scrap of an infant.
Isn't it just a proof of her blessed innocence?
My friend bravely inquired. She brought me, for the instant, almost round.
Oh, we must clutch at that. We must cling to it. If it isn't a proof of what you say, it's a proof of God knows what.
For the woman's a horror of horrors. Mrs. Groves, at this, fixed her eyes a minute on the ground, then at last raising them.
Tell me how you know, she said.
Then you admit it's what she was, I cried.
Tell me how you know, my friend simply repeated.
No. By seeing her. By the way she looked.
At you, do you mean? So wickedly?
Dear me, no. I could have borne that. She gave me never a glance. She only fixed the child. Mrs. Groves tried to see it.
Fixed her? Ah, oh, with such awful eyes.
She stared at mine as if they might really have resembled them.
Do you mean of dislike?
God help us, no. Of something much worse.
Worse than dislike?
This left her, indeed, at a loss. With a determination, indescribable, with a kind of fury of intention. I made her turn pale.
Intention?
To get hold of her. Mrs. Groves, her eyes just lingering on mine, gave a shudder and walked to the window, and while she stood there looking out, I completed my statement. That's what Flora knows. After a little, she turned round. The person was in black, you say? In mourning. Rather poor, almost shabby, but yes, with extraordinary beauty. I now recognised to what I had at last, stroke by stroke, brought the victim of my confidence, for she quite visibly weighed this. Oh, handsome. Very, very, I insisted. Wonderfully handsome. But infamous. She slowly came back to me.
Miss Jessel,
was infamous.
She once more took my hand in both her own, holding it as tight as if to fortify me against the increase of alarm I might draw from this disclosure.
They were both infamous, she finally said.
So, for a little, we faced it once more together, and I found absolutely a degree of help in seeing it now so straight. I appreciate, I said, the great decency of your not having hitherto spoken, but the time has certainly come to give me the whole thing. She appeared to assent to this, but still only in silence, seeing which I went on. I must have it now. Of what did she die? Come, there was something between them.
There was everything.
In spite of the difference?
Oh, of their rank, their condition?
She brought it woefully out.
She was a lady.
I turned it over, I again saw. Yes, she was a lady.
And he's so dreadfully below, said Mrs. Groves.
I felt that I doubtless needn't press too hard in such company on the place of a servant in the scale, but there was nothing to prevent an acceptance of my companion's own measure of my predecessor's abasement. There was a way to deal with that, and I dealt, the more readily for my full vision, on the evidence of our employer's late, clever, good-looking own man, impudent, assured, spoiled, depraved. The fellow was a hound. Mrs. Groves considered, as if it were perhaps a little a case for a sense of shades.
I've never seen one like him. He did what he wished.
With her?
With them all.
It was as if now in my friend's own eyes Miss Jessel had again appeared. I seemed, at any rate, for an instant, to see their evocation of her as distinctly as I had seen her by the pond, and I brought out with decision, it must have been also what she wished. Mrs. Groves's face signified that it had been indeed, but she said at the same time, poor woman, she paid for it.
Then you do know what she died of? I asked.
No, I know nothing. I wanted not to know. I was glad enough I didn't, and I thanked heaven she was well out of this. Yet you had then your idea
of a real reason for leaving. Oh, yes, as to that. She couldn't have stayed. Fancy it here. For a governess. And afterward I imagined, and I still imagine, and what I imagine is dreadful.
Not so dreadful as what I do, I replied, on which I must have shown her, as I was indeed but too conscious, a front of miserable defeat. It brought out again all her compassion for me, and at the renewed touch of her kindness, my power to resist broke down. I burst, as I had the other time, made her burst into tears. She took me to her motherly breast, and my lamentation overflowed.
I don't do it!
I sobbed in despair.
I don't save or shield them. It's far worse than I dreamed. They're lost.
8. What I had said to Mrs. Groves was true enough. There were in the matter I had put before her depths and possibilities that I lacked resolution to sound, so that when we met once more in the wonder of it, we were of a common mind about the duty of resistance to extravagant fancies. We were to keep our heads if we should keep nothing else, difficult indeed as that might be in the face of what in our prodigious experience was least to be questioned. Late that night, while the house slept, we had another talk in my room, when she went all the way with me as to its being beyond doubt that I had seen exactly what I had seen. To hold her perfectly in the pinch of that, I found I had only to ask her how, if I had made it up, I came to be able to give of each of the persons appearing to me a picture disclosing to the last detail their special marks, a portrait on the exhibition of which she had instantly recognised and named them. She wished, of course, small blame to her, to sink the whole subject, and I was quick to assure her that my own interest in it had now violently taken the form of a search for the way to escape from it. I encountered her on the ground of a probability that with recurrence, for recurrence we took for granted, I should get used to my danger, distinctly professing that my personal exposure had suddenly become the least of my discomforts. It was my new suspicion that was intolerable, and yet even to this complication, the later hours of the day had brought a little ease. On leaving her, after my first outbreak, I had of course returned to my pupils, associating the right remedy for my dismay with that sense of their charm which I had already found to be a thing I could positively cultivate and which had never failed me yet. I had simply, in other words, plunged afresh into Flora's special society, and there become aware, it was almost a luxury, that she could put her little conscious hand straight upon the spot that ached. She had looked at me in sweet speculation, and then had accused me, to my face, of having cried. I had supposed I had brushed away the ugly signs, but I could literally, for the time at all events, rejoice under this fathomless charity that they had not entirely disappeared. To gaze into the depths of blue of the child's eyes and pronounce their loveliness a trick of premature cunning was to be guilty of a cynicism in preference to which I naturally preferred to abjure my judgment, and, so far as might be, my agitation. I couldn't abjure for merely wanting to, but I could repeat to Mrs. Groves, as I did there, over and over in the small hours, that with their voices in the air, their pressure on one's heart, and their fragrant faces against one's cheek, everything fell to the ground but their incapacity and their beauty. It was a pity that somehow to settle this once and for all, I had equally to re-enumerate the signs of subtlety that in the afternoon by the lake had made a miracle of my show of self-possession. It was a pity to be obliged to reinvestigate the certitude of the moment itself, and repeat how it had come to me as a revelation that the inconceivable communion I then surprised was a matter, for either party, of habit. It was a pity that I should have had to quaver out again the reasons for my not having, in my delusion, so much as questioned that the little girl saw our visitant even as I actually saw Mrs. Groves herself, and that she wanted, by just so much as she did thus see, to make me suppose she didn't, and at the same time, without showing anything, arrive at a guess as to whether I myself did. It was a pity that I needed once more to describe the portentous little activity by which she sought to divert my attention. The perceptible increase of movement, the greater intensity of play, the singing, the gabbling of nonsense, and the invitation to romp. Yet if I had not indulged, to prove there was nothing in it, in this review, I should have missed the two or three dim elements of comfort that still remained to me. I should not, for instance, have been able to asseverate to my friend that I was certain, which was so much to the good, that I, at least, had not betrayed myself. I should not have been prompted, by stress of need, by desperation of mind, I scarce know what to call it, to invoke such further aid to intelligence as might spring from pushing my colleague fairly to the wall. She had told me, bit by bit, under pressure, a great deal. But a small, shifty spot on the wrong side of it all still sometimes brushed my brow like the wing of a bat. And I remember how on this occasion, for the sleeping house and the concentration alike of our danger and our watch seemed to help, I felt the importance of giving the last jerk to the curtain. "I don't believe anything so horrible," I recollect saying. "No, let us put it definitely, my dear, that I don't. But if I did, you know, there's a thing I should require now, just without sparing you the least bit more, oh, not a scrap, come, to get out of you. What was it you had in mind when, in our distress, before Miles came back, over the letter from his school, you said, under my insistence, that you didn't pretend for him that he had not literally ever been bad? He has not, literally, ever, in these weeks that I myself have lived with him and so closely watched him. He's been an imperturbable little prodigy of delightful, lovable goodness. Therefore, you might perfectly have made the claim for him if you had not, as it happened, seen an exception to take. What was your exception? And to what passage in your personal observation of him did you refer?
It was a dreadfully austere inquiry, but levity was not our note, and at any rate, before the grey dawn admonished us to separate, I had got my answer. What my friend had had in mind proved to be immensely to the purpose. It was neither more nor less than the circumstance that for a period of several months Quint and the boy had been perpetually together. It was, in fact, the very appropriate truth that she had ventured to criticise the propriety, to hint at the incongruity of so close an alliance, and even to go so far on the subject as a frank overture to Miss Jessel. Miss Jessel had, with a most strange manner, requested her to mind her business, and the good woman had, on this, directly approached little Miles. What she had said to him, since I pressed, was that she liked to see young gentlemen not forget their station. I pressed again, of course, at this. You reminded him that Quint was only a base menial.
As you might say. And it was his answer, for one thing, that was bad.
And for another thing? I waited. He repeated your words to Quint?
No, not that. It's just what he wouldn't.
She could still impress upon me.
I was sure at any rate, she added, that he didn't. But he denied certain occasions.
What occasions?
When they had been about together, quite as if Quint were his tutor, and a very grand one, and Miss Jessel only for the little lady. When he had gone off with the fellow, I mean, and spent hours with him.
He then prevaricated about him. He said he hadn't. Her assent was clear enough to cause me to add in a moment.
I see.
He lied.
Oh,
Mrs. Groves mumbled. This was a suggestion that it didn't matter, which indeed she backed up by a further remark.
You see, after all, Miss Jessel didn't mind. She didn't forbid him.
I considered. Did he put that to you as a justification? At this, she dropped again.
No, he never spoke of it.
Never mentioned her in connection with Quint? She saw, visibly flushing, where I was coming out.
Well, he didn't show anything. He denied, she repeated. He denied.
Lord, how I pressed her now. So that you could see he knew what was between the two wretches.
I don't know, I don't know, the poor woman groaned.
You do know, you dear thing, I replied. Only you haven't my dreadful boldness of mind, and you keep back out of timidity and modesty and delicacy even the impression that in the past, when you had without my aid to flounder about in silence, most of all made you miserable. But I shall get it out of you yet. There was something in the boy that suggested to you, I continued, that he covered and concealed their relation.
Oh, we couldn't prevent.
You're learning the truth, I dare say. But heavens, I fell with vehemence a-thinking, what it shows that they must to that extent have succeeded in making of him.
Oh, nothing that's not nice now,
Mrs. Groves lugubriously pleaded. I don't wonder you looked queer, I persisted, when I mentioned to you the letter from his school.
I doubt if I looked as queer as you, she retorted with homely force. And if he was so bad then, as that comes to, how is he such an angel now?
Yes, indeed. And if he was a fiend at school, how? Well, I said in my torment, you must put it to me again, but I shall not be able to tell you for some days. Only put it to me again, I cried in a way that made my friend stare. There are directions in which I must not, for the present, let myself go. Meanwhile, I returned to her first example, the one to which she had just previously referred, of the boy's happy capacity for an occasional slip. If Quint, on your remonstrance at the time you speak of, was a base menial, one of the things Miles said to you, I find myself guessing, was that you were another. Again, her admission was so adequate that I continued. And you forgave him that?
Wouldn't you?
Oh, yes. And we exchanged there, in the stillness, a sound of the oddest amusement. Then I went on. At all events, while he was with the man, Miss Flora was with the woman. It suited them all. It suited me, too, I felt, only too well, by which I mean that it suited exactly the particularly deadly view I was in the very act of forbidding myself to entertain. But I so far succeeded in checking the expression of this view that I will throw just here no further light on it than may be offered by the mention of my final observation to Mrs. Groves. His having lied and been impudent are, I confess, less engaging specimens than I had hoped to have from you of the outbreak in him of the little natural man. Still, I mused, they must do, for they make me feel more than ever that I must watch. It made me blush the next minute to see in my friend's face how much more unreservedly she had forgiven him than her anecdote struck me as presenting to my own tenderness an occasion for doing. This came out when, at the schoolroom door, she quitted me.
"Surely you don't accuse him
of carrying on an intercourse that he conceals from me? Ah, remember that until further evidence I now accuse nobody." Then, before shutting her out to go by another passage to her own place, "I must just wait," I wound up. 9. I waited and waited, and the days, as they elapsed, took something from my consternation. A very few of them, in fact, passing in constant sight of my pupils without a fresh incident, sufficed to give to grievous fancies and even to odious memories a kind of brush of the sponge. I have spoken of the surrender to their extraordinary childish grace as a thing I could actively cultivate, and it may be imagined if I neglected now to address myself to this source for whatever it would yield. Stranger than I can express, certainly, was the effort to struggle against my new lights. It would doubtless have been, however, a greater tension still had it not been so frequently successful. I used to wonder how my little charges could help guessing that I thought strange things about them, and the circumstances that these things only made them more interesting was not by itself a direct aid to keeping them in the dark. I trembled lest they should see that they were so immensely more interesting. Putting things at the worst, at all events, as in meditation I so often did, any clouding of their innocence could only be, blameless and foredoomed as they were, a reason the more for taking risks. There were moments when, by an irresistible impulse, I found myself catching them up and pressing them to my heart. As soon as I'd done so, I'd say to myself, "What will they think of that? Doesn't it betray too much?" It would have been easy to get into a sad, wild tangle about how much I might betray, but the real account, I feel, of the hours of peace that I could still enjoy was that the immediate charm of my companions was a beguilement still effective, even under the shadow of the possibility that it was studied. For if it occurred to me that I might occasionally excite suspicion by the little outbreaks of my sharper passion for them, so, too, I remember wondering if I mightn't see a queerness in the traceable increase of their own demonstrations. They were, at this period, extravagantly and preternaturally fond of me, which, after all, I could reflect was no more than a graceful response in children perpetually bowed over and hugged. The homage, of which they were so lavish, succeeded in truth for my nerves, quite as well as if I never appeared to myself, as I may say, literally to catch them at a purpose in it. They had never, I think, wanted to do so many things for their poor protectress. I mean, though they got their lessons better and better, which was naturally what would please her most, in the way of diverting, entertaining, surprising her, reading her passages, telling her stories, acting her charades, pouncing out at her in disguises as animals and historical characters, and above all, astonishing her by the pieces they had secretly got by heart and could interminably recite. I should never get to the bottom, were I to let myself go even now, of the prodigious private commentary, all under still more private correction with which in these days I overscored their full hours. They had shown me from the first a facility for everything, a general faculty which, taking a fresh start, achieved remarkable flights. They got their little tasks as if they loved them, and indulged from the mere exuberance of the gift in the most unimposed little miracles of memory. They not only popped out at me as tigers and as Romans, but as Shakespeareans, astronomers and navigators. This was so singularly the case that it had presumably much to do with the fact as to which at the present day I am at a loss for a different explanation. I allude to my unnatural composure on the subject of another school for Miles. What I remember is that I was content not, for the time, to open the question, and that contentment must have sprung from the sense of his perpetually striking show of cleverness. He was too clever for a bad governess, for a parson's daughter, to spoil, and the strangest, if not the brightest, thread in the pensive embroidery I just spoke of was the impression I might have got, if I had dared to work it out, that he was under some influence operating in his small intellectual life as a tremendous incitement. If it was easy to reflect, however, that such a boy could postpone school, it was at least as marked that for such a boy to have been kicked out by a schoolmaster was a mystification without end. Let me add that in their company now, and I was careful almost never to be out of it, I could follow no scent very far. We lived in a cloud of music and love and success and private theatricals. The musical sense in each of the children was of the quickest, but the elder in especial had a marvellous knack of catching and repeating. The schoolroom piano broke into all gruesome fancies, and when that failed there were confabulations in corners, with a sequel of one of them going out in the highest spirits in order to come in as something new. I had had brothers myself, and it was no revelation to me that little girls could be slavish idolaters of little boys. What surpassed everything was that there was a little boy in the world who could have, for the inferior age, sex and intelligence, so fine a consideration. They were extraordinarily at one, and to say that they never either quarrelled or complained is to make the note of praise coarse for their quality of sweetness. Sometimes, indeed, when I dropped into coarseness, I perhaps came across traces of little understandings between them by which one of them should keep me occupied while the other slipped away. There is a naive side, I suppose, in all diplomacy. But if my pupils practised upon me, it was surely with the minimum of grossness. It was all in the other quarter that, after a lull, the grossness broke out. I find that I really hang back. But I must take my plunge. In going on with the record of what was hideous at Bligh, I not only challenge the most liberal faith, for which I little care, but, and this is another matter, I renew what I myself suffered. I again push my way through it to the end. There came suddenly an hour after which, as I look back, the affair seems to me to have been all pure suffering, but I have at least reached the heart of it, and the straightest road out is doubtless to advance. One evening, with nothing to lead up or to prepare it, I felt the cold touch of the impression that had breathed on me the night of my arrival, and which, much lighter then, as I have mentioned, I should probably have made little of in memory had my subsequent sojourn been less agitated. I had not gone to bed. I sat reading by a couple of candles. There was a room full of old books at Bligh, last-century fiction, some of it, which, to the extent of a distinctly deprecated renown, but never to so much as that of a stray specimen, had reached the sequestered home and appealed to the unavowed curiosity of my youth. I remember that the book I had in my hand was Fielding's Amelia, also that I was wholly awake. I recall further both a general conviction that it was horribly late, and a particular objection to looking at my watch. I figure, finally, that the white curtain draping in the fashion of those days, the head of Flora's little bed, shrouded, as I had assured myself long before, the perfection of childish rest. I recollect, in short, that, though I was deeply interested in my author, I found myself, at the turn of a page, and with his spell all scattered, looking straight up from him and hard at the door of my room. There was a moment during which I listened, reminded of the faint sense I had had the first night of there being something indefinably astir in the house, and noted the soft breath of the open casement just move the half-drawn blind. Then, with all the marks of a deliberation that must have seemed magnificent had there been anyone to admire it, I laid down my book, rose to my feet, and taking a candle, went straight out of the room and from the passage, on which my light made little impression, noiselessly closed and locked the door. I can say now neither what determined nor what guided me, but I went straight along the lobby holding my candle high till I came within sight of the tall window that presided over the great turn of the staircase. At this point I precipitately found myself aware of three things. They were practically simultaneous, yet they had flashes of succession. My candle, under a bold flourish, went out, and I perceived by the uncovered window that the yielding dusk of earliest morning rendered it unnecessary. Without it, the next instant, I saw that there was someone on the stair. I speak of sequences, but I required no lapse of seconds to stiffen myself for a third encounter with Quint. The apparition had reached the landing halfway up and was therefore on the spot nearest the window, where at sight of me it stopped short and fixed me exactly as it had fixed me from the tower and from the garden. He knew me as well as I knew him, and so in the cold, faint twilight, with a glimmer in the high glass and another on the polish of the oak stair below, we faced each other in our common intensity. He was absolutely, on this occasion, a living, detestable, dangerous presence. But that was not the wonder of wonders. I reserve this distinction for quite another circumstance, the circumstance that dread had unmistakably quitted me, and that there was nothing in me there that didn't meet and measure him. I had plenty of anguish after that extraordinary moment, but I had, thank God, no terror. And he knew I had not. I found myself at the end of an instant magnificently aware of this. I felt, in a fierce rigour of confidence, that if I stood my ground a minute, I should cease, for the time at least, to have him to reckon with. And during the minute, accordingly, the thing was as human and hideous as a real interview. Hideous just because it was human. As human as to have met alone in the small hours in a sleeping house some enemy, some adventurer, some criminal. It was the dead silence of our long gaze at such close quarters that gave the whole horror, huge as it was, its only note of the unnatural. If I had met a murderer in such a place and at such an hour, we still at least would have spoken. Something would have passed in life between us. If nothing had passed, one of us would have moved. The moment was so prolonged that it would have taken but little more to make me doubt if even I were in life. I can't express what followed it, save by saying that the silence itself, which was indeed in a manner an attestation of my strength, became the element into which I saw the figure disappear, in which I definitely saw it turn as I might have seen the low wretch to which it had once belonged turn on receipt of an order and pass with my eyes on the villainous back that no hunch could have more disfigured straight down the staircase and into the darkness in which the next bend was lost. 10. I remained a while at the top of the stair, but with the effect presently of understanding that when my visitor had gone, he had gone, then I returned to my room. The foremost thing I saw there by the light of the candle I had left burning was that Flora's little bed was empty, and on this I caught my breath with all the terror that 5 minutes before I had been able to resist. I dashed at the place in which I had left her lying, and over which, for the small silk counterpane and the sheets were disarranged. The white curtains had been deceivingly pulled forward. Then my step, to my unutterable relief, produced an answering sound. I perceived an agitation of the window blind, and the child, ducking down, emerged, rosily, from the other side of it. She stood there in so much of her candour and so little of her nightgown, with her pink bare feet and the golden glow of her curls. She looked intensely grave, and I had never had such a sense of losing an advantage acquired, the thrill of which had just been so prodigious, as on my consciousness that she addressed me with a reproach.
"You naughty! Where have you been?"
Instead of challenging her own irregularity, I found myself arraigned and explaining. She herself explained, for that matter, with the loveliest, eagerest simplicity. She had known suddenly, as she lay there, that I was out of the room, and had jumped up to see what had become of me. I had dropped, with the joy of her reappearance, back into my chair, feeling then, and then only, a little faint. And she had pattered straight over to me, thrown herself upon my knee, given herself to be held with the flame of the candle full in the wonderful little face that was still flushed with sleep. I remember closing my eyes an instant, yieldingly, consciously, as before the excess of something beautiful that shone out of the blue of her own. "You were looking for me out of the window," I said. "You thought I might be walking in the grounds?"
"Well, you know, I thought someone was."
She never blanched as she smiled out that at me. Oh, how I looked at her now. "And did you see anyone?"
"Ah, no,"
she returned, almost with the full privilege of childish inconsequence, resentfully, though with a long sweetness in her little drawl of the negative. At that moment, in the state of my nerves, I absolutely believed she lied, and if I once more closed my eyes, it was before the dazzle of the three or four possible ways in which I might take this up. One of these, for a moment, tempted me with such singular intensity that to withstand it I must have gripped my little girl with a spasm that wonderfully she submitted to without a cry or a sign of fright. Why not break out at her on the spot and have it all over, give it to her straight in her lovely little lighted face? "You see, you see, you know that you do, and that you already quite suspect I believe it. Therefore, why not frankly confess it to me, so that we may at least live with it together and learn, perhaps, in the strangeness of our fate, where we are and what it means?" This solicitation dropped, alas, as it came. If I could immediately have succumbed to it, I might have spared myself. Well, you'll see what. Instead of succumbing, I sprang again to my feet, looked at her bed, and took a helpless middle way. "Why did you pull the curtain over the place to make me think you were still there?" Flora luminously considered, after which, with her little divine smile,
"Because I don't like to frighten you."
"But if I had, by your idea, gone out?" She absolutely declined to be puzzled. She turned her eyes to the flame of the candle as if the question were as irrelevant, or at any rate as impersonal, as Mrs. Marcet or 9 times 9.
"Oh, but you know," she quite adequately answered, "that you might come back, you dear, and that you have."
And after a little, when she had got into bed, I had for a long time, by almost sitting on her to hold her hand, to prove that I recognised the pertinence of my return. You may imagine the general complexion from that moment of my nights. I repeatedly sat up till I didn't know when. I selected moments when my roommate unmistakably slept, and stealing out, took noiseless turns in the passage, and even pushed as far as to where I had last met Quint. But I never met him there again, and I may as well say at once that I on no other occasion saw him in the house. I just missed, on the staircase, on the other hand, a different adventure. Looking down it from the top, I once recognised the presence of a woman seated on one of the lower steps with her back presented to me, her body half bowed, and her head in an attitude of woe in her hands. I had been there but an instant, however, when she vanished without looking round at me. I knew, nonetheless, exactly what dreadful face she had to show, and I wondered whether, if instead of being above I had been below, I should have had, for going up, the same nerve I had lately shown Quint. Well, there continued to be plenty of chance for nerve. On the 11th night after my latest encounter with that gentleman, they were all numbered now, I had an alarm that perilously skirted it, and that, indeed, from the particular quality of its unexpectedness, proved quite my sharpest shock. It was precisely the first night during this series that, weary with watching, I had felt that I might again, without laxity, lay myself down at my old hour. I slept immediately, and, as I afterward knew, till about 1 o'clock, but when I woke it was to sit straight up, as completely roused as if a hand had shook me. I had left a light burning, but it was now out, and I felt an instant certainty that Flora had extinguished it. This brought me to my feet and straight in the darkness to her bed, which I found she had left. A glance at the window enlightened me further, and the striking of a match completed the picture. The child had again got up, this time blowing out the taper, and had again, for some purpose of observation or response, squeezed in behind the blind and was peering out into the night. That she now saw, as she had not, I had satisfied myself the previous time, was proved to me by the fact that she was disturbed neither by my re-illumination nor by the haste I made to get into slippers and into a wrap. Hidden, protected, absorbed, she evidently rested on the sill, the casement opened forward, and gave herself up. There was a great still moon to help her, and this fact had counted in my quick decision. She was face to face with the apparition we had met at the lake, and could now communicate with it as she had not then been able to do. What I, on my side, had to care for was, without disturbing her, to reach from the corridor some other window in the same quarter. I got to the door without her hearing me. I got out of it, closed it, and listened from the other side for some sound from her. While I stood in the passage, I had my eyes on her brother's door, which was but 10 steps off, and which, indescribably, produced in me a renewal of the strange impulse that I lately spoke of as my temptation. What if I should go straight in and march to his window? What if, by risking to his boyish bewilderment a revelation of my motive, I should throw across the rest of the mystery the long halter of my boldness? This thought held me sufficiently to make me cross to his threshold and pause again. I preternaturally listened. I figured to myself what might portentously be. I wondered if his bed were also empty, and he too were secretly at watch. It was a deep, soundless minute, at the end of which my impulse failed. He was quiet. He might be innocent. The risk was hideous. I turned away. There was a figure in the grounds, a figure prowling for a sight, the visitor with whom Flora was engaged, but it was not the visitor most concerned with my boy. I hesitated afresh, but on other grounds and only for a few seconds. Then I had made my choice. There were empty rooms at Bly, and it was only a question of choosing the right one. The right one suddenly presented itself to me as the lower one, though high above the gardens, in the solid corner of the house that I have spoken of as the old tower. This was a large, square chamber, arranged with some state as a bedroom, the extravagant size of which made it so inconvenient that it had not for years, though kept by Mrs. Groves in exemplary order, been occupied. I had often admired it, and I knew my way about in it. I had only, after just faltering at the first chill gloom of its disuse, to pass across it and unbolt as quietly as I could one of the shutters. Achieving this transit, I uncovered the glass without a sound, and, applying my face to the pane, was able, the darkness without being much less than within, to see that I commanded the right direction. Then I saw something more. The moon made the night extraordinarily penetrable, and showed me on the lawn a person, diminished by distance, who stood there, motionless and as if fascinated, looking up to where I had appeared, looking, that is, not so much straight at me as at something that was apparently above me. There was clearly another person above me. There was a person on the tower. But the presence on the lawn was not in the least what I had conceived and had confidently hurried to meet. The presence on the lawn, I felt sick as I made it out, was poor little Miles himself. 11. It was not till late next day that I spoke to Mrs. Groves, the rigour with which I kept my pupils in sight making it often difficult to meet her privately, and the more as we each felt the importance of not provoking, on the part of the servants quite as much as on that of the children, any suspicion of a secret flurry or that of a discussion of mysteries. I drew a great security in this particular from her mere smooth aspect. There was nothing in her fresh face to pass on to others my horrible confidences. She believed me, I was sure, absolutely. If she hadn't, I don't know what